she was told.
I think she works for the family.
Did you try, because I do have spread. I have spread. I'm a small girl. Hi. Hi. Thank you for having us. So, everyone, they have a chance for us.
Where the guy turned on the wall, fell with the truck. That guy fixed it for us in his garage. That's how Coop's great.
Well, that looks good.
Yeah, I think it's good. Thanks so much. And I'm all about that. I'll just put it right here on the shelf if you want.
Today's Hinckley Forum will be recorded for radio broadcast. Please turn off cell phones as they cause significant interference with our microphones. We'll begin in a moment. Thank you. Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Maher, and I'll be your host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 under the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Hinckley Institute strives to teach students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen engagement in politics. The Hinckley Institute offers internships to students of all majors here locally, in D.C., and in 35 nations around the globe. Hinckley also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in D.C., and over $400,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is the Kerry Initiative, Hope for Resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. The Peace Advocacy Coalition is a group of independent peace activists from various educational institutions and activist groups based along the Wasatch Front in Utah. In order to promote awareness, knowledge, and discussion, PAC hosts an interesting repository of guest lectures on the subject of peace each year. Today's forum is one of those lectures. Coming up, we also have one on the NSA and our constitutional rights and pursuing peace healing in 9/11. Today's guest is Dr. Stephen Zunes. He is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he served as coordinator of the program of the Middle East Studies. He has been recognized as one of the country's leading scholars of U.S. Mideast policy and of strategic nonviolent action. Professor Zunes serves as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy and Focus Project of the Institute for Policy Studies, an association editor for Peace Review, a contributing editor for Tikkun, and co-chair of the Academic Advisory Committee for the International Center of Nonviolent Conflict. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Thank you. It's great to be back here at the University of Utah and the Hinckley Institute. For quite a few years now, there has been a broad international consensus as to what an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement would look like. That would be that specifically the establishment of an independent Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza Strip, the territory seized by Israel in the 1967 war. Recognition of Israel within its internationally recognized pre-1967 borders with minor and reciprocal adjustments with the Palestinian state. Strict security guarantees for Israel. A withdrawal from the majority of illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied territories, and a just resolution to the problem of Palestinian refugees, which would presumably not include wholesale repatriation to their former homes in Israel, but resettlement within the new Palestinian state and other Arab lands. For the first 2.5 decades of the conflict, the Palestinians and other Arab nations were the more intransigent parties, rejecting Israel's very right to exist, rejecting an end of hostilities, and even rejecting direct negotiations. However, in subsequent years, there's been a major shift in Arab thinking away from such rejectionism and towards supporting something approximating the international consensus. As far back as 1976, the Palestine Liberation Organization, the government exile of the Palestinians, quietly supported a UN Security Council resolution, which reiterated the language of UN Security Council Resolutions 242 and 338, the Land for Peace Initiative, with the additional proviso there would be an establishment of a Palestinian state, something that was not included in 242. Indeed, the Palestinians weren't even mentioned by name in 242. Unfortunately, the United States vetoed that resolution, the only dissenting vote in the 15-member Security Council. In 1988, the Palestine Liberation Organization unilaterally recognized Israel, renounced terrorism, accepted 242 and 338 as the basis of negotiations, even though Israel had refused to reciprocate on those points. And then the PLO codified this in 1993 in the Declaration of Principles negotiated in Oslo and signed in Washington, D.C. And within a couple years, they removed from the PLO charter any language which implied the dissolution of the State of Israel. In 2002, at the Beirut summit of the League of Arab States, the Arab nations adopted a plan put together by then Crown Prince, now King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, which for the first time formalized Arab support for 242 and 338, that is, land for peace, security guarantees, recognition of Israel, and return for the withdrawal from the occupied territories. And subsequent announcements by the president of the Palestine Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, as well as some leaks of the negotiating position by the Palestinians obtained by Al Jazeera, indicate that the Palestine Authority has, for all intents and purposes, accepted this international consensus. Unfortunately, Israel, during this period, has, if anything, gone in the opposite direction. And indeed, the current Israeli government is probably the most right-wing Israeli government they've ever had, which is unfortunate because under the leadership of Abbas, the Palestine Authority now has probably the most moderate government the Palestinians ever had. And the Israeli position is that Israel should be able to hold on to the majority of the settlements in the occupied territories. And this is despite the fact that the Fourth Geneva Convention prohibits any nation from transferring any part of its civilian population onto territories seized by military force. The application of this principle was made official in a series of UN Security Council resolutions, 446, 452, 465, and 471, and was also recognized in a landmark 2004 decision by the International Court of Justice. And indeed, the development of these illegal settlements deep inside Palestinian territory has made the establishment of a contiguous a Palestinian state, and therefore a viable Palestinian state, virtually impossible. Regarding the concept of land for peace, which is the thrust of resolutions 242 and 338, the Israelis have effectively redefined that from simply meaning that the existential threat of Israel, with Arab armies massing on its border, threatening to wipe Israel off the map, as you had prior to 1967, and the presumed acceptance of some kind of international monitoring, demilitarization, arms control, diplomatic and recognition, etc. The Israelis have basically said that means the physical safety of every Israeli, meaning that if some extremist Palestinian group like Hamas or Islamist Jihad, sends rockets into Israel or engages in a terrorist attack, therefore, it's argued Israel has no obligation to give up the lands it seized in the June 67 war, essentially, and ironically, making an incentive for the extremists who don't want to see the peace process move forward to engage in these kinds of horrific attacks. The Israeli position is also that Israel should be able to continue to occupy large parts of the West Bank. Making a contiguous Palestinian state impossible. And it works on the assumption that the 22% of Palestine, that is the West Bank and Gaza Strip, is somehow too much, that the Palestinians need to settle for even less. And holding on to territory seized by military force, of course, is a violation of the United Nations Charter and the longstanding international legal principle that it is illegal for any country to incorporate, annex land that was obtained through invasion and occupation. Israel's position also is that Jerusalem should be under the exclusive Israeli control. This is a contrast with the international consensus that the Arab neighborhood should be under Palestine, and the Jewish neighborhoods, including many of the illegal settlements in the Jerusalem area, be incorporated into Israel as a co-capital of both states. But the Israeli position is no, they should control all of this area, including the more than 250,000 Palestinians who live in the Arab sectors of occupied East Jerusalem. This is this is a direct violation of the UN Security, not just 242 and 338, but Security Council Resolutions 252, 267, 271, and others, which have declared that Israel's unilateral annexation of Greater East Jerusalem is null and void. And let's remember that Jerusalem is not just important for Muslim and Christian Palestinians for religious reasons, but historically it's been the center of commercial, educational, and cultural life. So the idea of having a Palestinian state without Jerusalem as its capital seems really unrealistic. Now, I'm pointing this out because there are a lot of good reasons why the United States has its long-standing commitment to Israel. Israel's democratic institutions, progressive traditions, its important role as a homeland for historically oppressed people, the close strategic and economic relationship the United States has with Israel, as well as their ideological affinity and the like. And there are certainly many negative things you can say about the Palestine Authority, especially under Yasser Arafat's leadership, but even more recently as well. But the fact is that on most of the outstanding issues in the peace process, the Palestine Authority takes a more moderate position than does Israel. That the Palestinian Authority's positions are far closer to that of the international consensus of international legal norms than is that of Israel. And I would argue that the problem is that United States diplomacy has not recognized that. We have allowed our strong strategic alliance with Israel to override and to ignore this shift, which has happened over the past few decades. And furthermore, I would argue there is an inherent contradiction between the role the United States plays as being the chief mediator of the conflict and our role as the chief military, financial, and diplomatic supporter of one of the two parties of the conflict. Indeed, the far more powerful of the two parties of the conflict. And in this role, we have essentially blocked anybody else from being a mediator. The United States has used its veto power 43 times at the United Nations as a sole dissenting vote in the Security Council to block the United Nations from enforcing international law in regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And to this day, U.S. position, as articulated by Obama's until recently ambassador to the UN Security Council, now National Security Advisor Susan Rice, saying that it would be unwise for the United Nations to play a role in the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. And this is, the United Nations, the Security Council historically has been the main principal body by which international disputes were addressed. But the U.S. position is not when it comes to Israel-Palestine, that this is our area to control. Indeed, Madeleine Albright, Clinton's ambassador to the United Nations, said that all previous Security Council resolutions are no longer relevant because of the leadership the United States has taken in the UN Security Council, and similarly, the U.S. has reacted negatively to efforts by the European Union and the Arab League, and other efforts. And I would argue that this has actually held back the peace process because the United States really has not been what you could call an honest broker. Indeed, for years. The United States was on in a mirror image of Iran, other extremists that refused to recognize Israel's right to exist. The United States was on record opposing Palestine's right to exist. You know, John Kerry, for much of his Senate career, was on record opposing Palestine's right to exist. And you know, now he is leading our negotiating efforts. In fact, the United States only became open to the idea of Palestinian statehood after the Israeli government became open to the idea of Palestinian statehood. We also refused to even talk with the Palestinians. Under the leadership of the Palestine Liberation Organization, which, for better or worse, was constituted the Palestinian government in exile, even after they unilaterally recognized Israel in 1988. And in fact, in 1991, the United States convened a peace conference between Israel and its Arab neighbors in Madrid, but refused to allow the Palestinians to take part in the talks, except as a subset of the Jordanian delegation. And we also insisted that none of the Palestinians could have any affiliation with the PLO, none of them could be from the Palestinian diaspora, and none of them could even be from Jerusalem. This is the first time, to my knowledge, there's been a peace negotiation in which the convener gave itself the right to say who could represent one of the parties. Despite this, however, the Palestinian delegation was represented by well-respected intellectuals who were in regular dialogue, with the PLO in the process. But the Israelis, who by 1992 found themselves under the leadership of the more moderate Labor Party under Yitzhak Rabin, were frustrated at the lack of progress. They actually, in part because they were getting a lot of pressure from the right wing in Israel that was opposing any kind of negotiations. So they quietly asked the Clinton administration to publicly put pressure on them to compromise more, so they could sort of cover their right flank domestically, saying, yeah, but ISIS is really pushing us to compromise. But the Clinton administration refused. And so the Israelis, realizing they could probably do better talking to the PLO directly, but realizing they could not do that under Washington's auspices, did an end run around the United States and started meeting with the PLO secretly in Norway. The Clinton administration, which had come to office in early 1993, wasn't even aware this was going on, apparently. And indeed, the Clinton administration still adamantly opposed any kind of a Palestinian state. Proposed a kind of what they called autonomy proposal for some parts of the West Bank, which was actually less generous than what the Israelis were simultaneously offering the Palestinians in Oslo. And it was this offer that later became the framework for the Declaration of Principles. So this, so the Oslo Accords basically came despite of, rather than because of, U.S. diplomacy. Despite this, the United States became the guarantor of the Declarations of Principles. And there is that famous signing and handshake on the White House lawn in September of 1993. But unfortunately, while it did establish the Palestine Authority, the Israelis that still, there's no guarantee there could be a Palestinian state. And the Palestine Authority initially was consisted of maybe 80% of the Gaza Strip and a small area around Jericho in the West Bank, but eventually that grew to incorporate larger urban areas within the West Bank. But the so-called final status issues were postponed, which gave the Israeli government, which then came under the control of the right wing, to expand these illegal settlements. Now, the Palestinians thought that the language in the Declaration of Principles that neither party could prejudice the final outcome by unilateral actions included settlements. But Israel and the United States disagreed. They thought that settlements could continue to expand unless both sides agreed otherwise. And again, this is despite the UN Security Council resolutions, international law, saying that they were illegal. In fact, the U.S. even encouraged the expansion of settlements because a $10 billion loan guarantee agreed between the United States and Israel in 1992, which was to be dispensed in $2 billion installments annually, included a proviso that those $2 billion would that they would deduct from that $2 billion the cost of Israeli expansion of these illegal settlements, which came out between around $400 and $600 million annually. But the Clinton administration promised the Israelis that they would find a way to get around that, and sure enough, in my research, I noticed that the U.S. increased aid to Israel by almost the exact same amount as the annual deduction for the settlements. In other words, the Israelis knew that for every dollar they spent on expanding these illegal settlements, the United States would convert a loan guarantee into a grant. Furthermore, the Y River Memorandum, signed in 1996, the United States agreed to spend additional aid to fortify these illegal settlements and help the Israelis construct a series of Jewish-only highways that would bypass Palestinian communities, connecting these illegal settlements with each other and with Israel proper. This put the United States in direct defiance of UN Security Council Resolution 465, which forbid any member state from facilitating Israel's colonization drive in the occupied territories. Similarly, through a series of executive and legislative actions, the United States effectively recognized Israel's illegal annexation of occupied East Jerusalem and surrounding areas of the West Bank, and during a military offensive in 2002 in which Israel illegally reoccupied some parts that had been handed over to the Palestine Authority, the United States, despite being a guarantor of the disengagement agreement, refused to pressure Israel to withdraw. And so what happened was the Oslo process began to fall apart. The idea behind it was that if Palestinians were given a degree of autonomy and with hopes of getting more area and more autonomy leading to eventual independence, it would curb extremist groups that might engage in terrorism and other forms of violence against Israelis. And the Israelis feeling more confident would then allow the Palestinians to have more self-governance and control more of the occupied territory and essentially be a positive feedback loop. But instead, because of the expansion of these settlements and these highways and the fact that the Israelis ended up controlling the highways and connections between the various enclaves of Palestinian control, meaning commerce was interrupted and farmers couldn't get their crops to market, that kind of thing. Other perishables, women in childbirth having troubles, couldn't get to the hospital. I mean, people died in ambulances at these checkpoints. They still are, actually, to this day, because of and the economy was in a wreck because of all this. That a lot of people started to sour on the peace process, and you started to have an increase in terrorism. Support for Hamas, the extremist Islamist group, went from only 15% at the signing of the Oslo Accords, and then in a dozen years later, had gone up to almost 50%. So. In hopes to try to salvage the peace process, President Clinton tried to bring the parties together at Camp David, Maryland, the presidential retreat, in July of 2000. Palestinian leader and Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat said, "We're making some progress, but I don't think we're ready yet to figure out everything finally." And President Clinton said, "Oh, don't worry. If it doesn't work, I won't blame you." But unfortunately, that's exactly what Clinton did. Because despite the reports from the Clinton administration and members of Congress, you know, that this was a generous offer by Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, that it offered the Palestinians everything they wanted, including a capital in East Jerusalem and 97% of the West Bank, that was not, in fact, what was offered. It was not close to 97% because that did not include the areas of Greater East Jerusalem annexed by Israel and a huge swath of the West Bank and other parts that would be under indefinite lease by the Israeli army. And the so-called capital in Jerusalem was not in Jerusalem at all, but in an outlying village called Abu Dis. The quarter million Arabs would still be under Israeli control under this proposal. And the areas that the Palestinians had in the West Bank would be these four non-contiguous cantons where Israel would control the movement, not just between these cantons and Israel proper, which, of course, they had every right to do, but between the Palestinian areas and neighboring Arab states and between each section of the Palestinian territories. And indeed, they would... the Israelis would also control all the water rights of the aquifers, even those within under the Palestinian statelet, as well as the airspace and more. So it was something that even the most moderate Palestinian couldn't really support. But it was still more generous than what Israel had offered up till this point. And negotiations continued, even though fighting broke out in the fall of that year following the right-wing opposition leader Ariel Sharon's provocative visit to an Islamic holy site in occupied East Jerusalem. In December, President Clinton came out with a proposal that was getting close. The Israelis weren't quite ready to endorse it. The Palestine Authority wasn't quite ready to endorse it. But again, it looked like it had potential. And the two sides decided to work together without the United States. And in negotiations in Taba, Egypt, in January of 2001, they came very, very close to a peace agreement. And I think this is important to note, that the two sides did come very, very close to peace. Not in July of 2000 at Camp David under U.S. supervision, but in Taba, Egypt in January 2001, meeting on their own. Now, there are conflicting reports about what went on there, but it appears that Ehud Barak, who is facing a close re-election fight, and in fact the elections are going to be held the following week against Ariel Sharon, was afraid if he gave away too much, or was perceived to give away too much, that he would lose that election. So he backed off. But he ended up losing the election anyway, and was succeeded by Ariel Sharon, the right-wing opposition leader, who, of course, broke off talks and was not interested in pursuing the Clinton plan at all. Meanwhile, President Bush was elected, or became president around this time, and he wasn't interested in supporting the Clinton plan either. And so you had continued violence on both sides, including attacks on civilians by both sides, which continued for the next couple of years. President Bush's position was that the two sides just needed to work it out among themselves, which the problem with that, of course, was that if you're like me and you recognize that both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs have a right of self-determination and a state of their own and living in peace and security, it ignores the gross asymmetry in power between the occupier and the occupied. But the focus of the Bush administration was on Palestinian violence, not the occupation which spawned it. In fact, Congress passed a resolution supported by John Kerry and others that criticized President Bush for using the term the cycle of violence, insisting that it was Palestinian violence and Israeli self-defense. But, you know, while occupation and repression can never justify terrorism, I would argue that terrorism can never justify occupation and repression. Indeed, far more Palestinian civilians have died at the hands of Israeli occupation forces and Israeli settlers than have Israeli civilians died at the hands of a Palestinian terrorist. And while both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs have an equal right, in my view, to national self-determination, peace, and security, the fact is that Israel is occupying Palestine. Palestine is not occupying Israel. And historically, you know, the onus of responsibility belongs to the occupying power. I mean, you know, back in 1990-91, you could say a lot of negative things about the government of Kuwait, as you can at this day, but we didn't say when Iraq ended up invading and occupied Kuwait, you guys work it out among yourselves. We said, okay, you know, whatever one may think of the Kuwaiti government, Iraq has no right to invade and occupy it. Seeing how things are at loggerheads, and again, recognize the United States is not going to move the peace process forward, Israelis and Palestinians who are not in government, but you know had prominent positions in previous governments, got together in Geneva. So this included people who were, you know, for example, the former head of the Labour Party, former Knesset speaker, prominent cabinet officials, and Palestinians who had similar positions in the Palestine Authority previously. They got together, and in December 2003 came out what became known as Geneva Initiative, which was essentially what they came very close to agreeing to at Taba, along the lines of the international consensus that I spelled out at the start of this talk. And this was endorsed by all sorts of world leaders, from Tony Blair to Jimmy Carter to Mikhail Gorbachev to Kofi Annan to Lech Walesa, virtually the entire international community. While Arafat and the Palestine Authority fell short of formal endorsement, they spoke very positively of it. But the Israeli government condemned it. The good news, though, was that public opinion polls show that the majority of Palestinians and a slightly smaller majority of Israelis supported it. And so, you know, people were very excited. This could be the big breakthrough. Unfortunately, the Bush administration and Congress totally ignored it. And again, just to emphasize, the Palestinians are only asking for 22% of Palestine. But even though they essentially gave up 78% of Palestine and in the at the Oslo, the U.S. position, reiterated by both Republicans and Democrats, including John Kerry, was that the Palestinians must learn to compromise. Ariel Sharon was getting a lot of pressure from within Israel to accept the Geneva Initiative, and you actually started to have Israeli soldiers, even pilots, refuse to take part in attacks in the occupied territories, given the large amount of the civilian casualties. And so there was a real push for him to come up with something. So in April 2004, he went to Washington, D.C., and he had four disengagement agreements, assuming the United States would reject the first two or three of not being sufficient. He had these backup positions. I was in Israel at the time this happened. And Bush ended up accepting the first one, the one where there is the least, Israel's giving up the least. Namely, Sharon said, okay, we will withdraw these illegal settlements from Gaza and a few scattered outposts in the West Bank, but we're going to annex all these other settlements and the roads connecting them and the surrounding land, which basically would end up with the Palestinian so-called state looking like Swiss cheese. Or as Ariel Sharon himself said at one point, a pastrami sandwich. You know, again, very resembling, I think, the notorious Bantustans of apartheid South Africa, non-contiguous territories and surrounded by the occupying power. And John Kerry, who was then the incipient Democratic nominee for president, enthusiastically endorsed the Sharon's plan and defended Bush against criticisms that this was essentially abandoning 242 and 338 and allowing for this illegal annexation. This, of course, did not go well with the international community or with Israeli moderates, not to mention, of course, the Palestinians. So there is an effort initiated by by the European Union, the Russians, the United Nations, to join the United States to form what they called the Quartet, to have a roadmap for peace. That is, it was a step-by-step, a four-part disengagement where each side had reciprocal responsibilities. It was limited in details, which again gave advantage to the occupying power, but the Palestine Authority accepted it. The Israelis formally accepted it, but with 14 major reservations, which essentially undermine the roadmap's major provisions. That didn't bother President Bush or John Kerry at all, however. But what was interesting is it emphasized reciprocity. For example, it said that, that in stage one, the Palestine Authority had to clamp down on violence within their extremist group, by extremist groups within their jurisdiction. They had to make their government more transparent and accountable. Corruption was rampant. They had other problems. And they've largely been successful at that. Israel, meanwhile, had to withdraw from the territories it reconquered during the earlier fighting and to stop expanding its settlements. Israel refused to do its part of the bargain. But in response, John Kerry and other members of Congress sent a letter to President Bush saying that the roadmap should be based above all on the end of all Palestinian violence and the establishment of new Palestinian leadership. In other words, they said Palestine has to do all the things they have to do first before you can expect Israel to stop expanding settlements or do what the roadmap actually said they had to be doing simultaneously. Even though this roadmap was co-sponsored by Russia, the European, the United Nations, Kerry and the others insisted that no other government or entity other than the United States and Israel were responsible for monitoring progress on the ground. Again, it was an effort to give the United States and the final say in what was supposed to have been a multilateral process. When President Bush raised concern about Israel's separation barrier, and let me explain the separation barrier real briefly. Israel was building a series of 30-foot walls, and in some places they're dirt mounds with fences and surveillance material that originally was supposed to be along Israel's border. The idea that if there was an independent Palestinian state, even if they violated, the ceasefire or whatever, it would make it difficult to attack Israel or for terrorists to infiltrate. But instead of building it along their border, the Israeli government started to build it in a serpentine fashion deep inside the occupied territory to incorporate the settlements and surrounding land. So it ended up ended up incorporating some of the best agricultural areas of the West Bank. And some villages were literally surrounded by the wall. They cut families divided families, separated Palestinians from their schools, their churches and mosques, their medical facilities. John Kerry condemned Bush for criticizing this, and he also condemned the International Court of Justice for its unanimous ruling, say for the U.S. judge, that reiterated while Israel could build a barrier along its border, it couldn't build it as a part of a land grab to incorporate territories seized by military force. Again, Kerry denounced this, saying the World Court doesn't care about Israel's right to self-defense, and as if he didn't even read it, because he totally misrepresented what was actually in the 65-page ruling, very nuanced account analysis that took into account Israel's legitimate security concerns. And it's also about the time John Kerry stopped even using the word occupied territory and started using the word disputed territory. And this is important because disputed territory implies each side has equal right to the land, ignoring that it was recognized by the entire international community as a territory under foreign belligerent occupation. And furthermore, and this is important, the Fourth Geneva Conventions do not apply to disputed territories, which therefore negated any responsibility Israel had under international humanitarian law regarding the Palestinian population under occupation. Now, I mention all this because this is the same John Kerry whom Barack Obama is trusting to mediate the a peace agreement between Israel and Palestine. Now, when Obama came to office, he seemed to want to take a shift away from the more hardline position of Clinton and Bush, which allied with the right wing of Israel, the Likud bloc. Obama's position seemed to be closer to the labor alignment, some of the more center left, more moderate Israelis. He was definitely pro-Israel, but supporting the more moderate elements within Israel. And he called on Israel to stop expanding these illegal settlements. He didn't call for withdrawal from the settlements, as the United Nations and World Court and other people had. He just said, just don't build more. he was criticized, not just by the Republicans, but by Democrats as well. I mean, and when he said that, like 242 said, we should, 67 borders should be kind of the basis of talks, assuming there'd be these land swaps. Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, denounced Obama, saying, no one should set premature parameters about borders, about buildings, about anything else. And there were a number of resolutions in Congress, supported by Kerry and others, which seemed to imply support for the position taken by Netanyahu and the Israeli right wing against that of Obama. In fact, when Netanyahu spoke before a joint session of Congress 2 years ago, he was repeatedly interrupted by applause. In fact, he got more applause, he was interrupted by applause more than and Barack Obama was at his State of the Union address just a few weeks earlier. And never in history has there been such a huge bipartisan repudiation of diplomatic efforts by an American president in favor of a foreign leader. And when Netanyahu made clear that the what he envisioned in terms of a Palestinian statehood, which he said would be it's a wrenching compromise by Israel to allow the Palestinians to have a state. But he said Israel would hold on to all of Greater East Jerusalem, including the Arab sections, be permanently annexed to Israel. As with the Jordan Valley on the other end of the West Bank, that would be under permanent Israeli control, and large swaths of territory in between to incorporate the settlements and the areas surrounding them, which would leave the Palestinians with a whole series of these non-contiguous cantons. I mean, at least Barak's proposal, back in 2000, Ehud Barak's proposal included four large chunks. Netanyahu's proposal, we're talking about dozens of these little teeny tiny chunks, and incorporating less land. And again, he was interrupted repeatedly by applause. Nancy Pelosi, told him, "It's clear that both sides of the Capitol believe that you advance the cause of peace." Well, President Abbas and the moderates, are getting pretty discouraged at this point. So they decided to go to the United Nations directly and ask them to recognize Palestine as a state. So even if they only controlled a tiny part of the territory, at least the status of statehood might give them more leverage internationally. Well, the Obama administration made clear that was totally unacceptable. And indeed, Congress passed with only six dissenting votes, the entire House of Representatives, a resolution that said no Palestinian state should be accepted except what the Israeli government would agree to, namely In the case of Netanyahu, a series of dozens of tiny non-contiguous cantons surrounded by Israel. And Obama said the United States would veto any membership of Palestine in the United Nations. So the Palestinians agreed that the General Assembly would allow them to, as an observer status, which did not require going to the Security Council where the UN could veto, as a non-member state. But then the Obama administration said, well, if Palestine becomes a member of any UN body, we'll withdraw all funding from that body. Now, allocation to the United Nations is based on a country's gross national product relative to the gross world product. And the United States, still being the most powerful economy in the world, that comes to about 23% of the UN budget. And so when Palestine was admitted to the UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Social, and Cultural Organization, the group that does really important work in terms of restoring, historic landmarks and environmental preservation, and a lot of really good work in promoting women's rights around the world. They're one of the UN agencies that actually works and works pretty effectively. The U.S. cut off all funding. And they've been suffering in the projects they support have been suffering as a whole. We also made clear if Palestine joined the World Health Organization, that we'd cut all our funding for that too. And the Palestinians, recognizing this would literally this would lead to the deaths of many hundreds of thousands of people who'd no longer be able to get vaccines or oral rehydration or AIDS prevention and that kind of thing, decide they would stop at UNESCO. They would not try to join any other a UN body. But so right now they are still hoping the United States, under John Kerry's leadership, will somehow play the role of an honest broker. It's unclear exactly what's going on. These negotiations are under wraps. There have been various leaks. It appears that Secretary of State Kerry is pushing the Palestinians to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Now, the Palestinians have already recognized Israel as a state, but now the U.S. is insisting that they recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Now, this is a new demand. No previous, prior to Netanyahu, no previous Israeli government had made that demand. Indeed, the peace treaties between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Jordan, which have held and have been honored, neither Egypt nor Jordan were required to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Indeed, to my knowledge, no peace agreement in world history has ever required one party to formally recognize the ethnic or religious identity of the other state. But this is what the United States is demanding of the Palestinians. But politically, that would be virtually impossible for President Abbas to do, because for one thing, 20% of the population of Israel proper, not even talking about the occupied territories or the land that might be incorporated in land swaths, but within Israel's internationally recognized borders, 20% of the population are Palestinians, non-Jewish Palestinians. And what does that mean for their rights? And there are other reasons as too, but it appears it might be a way of kind of setting things up so that if the talks fail, we can like in 2000, we can once again blame the Palestinians. So again, the Palestinians have recognized Israel's existence as a state with security guarantees, to demilitarize the Palestinian state, to allow international peacekeepers, even some Israeli troops, to guard the border. I mean, all these things for Israel's security. But yet now the United States is saying that's not enough. You need removing the goalposts in a sense and saying no, you have to recognize them as a Jewish state. At the same time, he does also appear to be pushing Israel to withdraw from at least some of the settlements, and try to do some kind of land swap so that if Israel ends up incorporating these settlements near the old border, the parts of Arab populated parts of what's now Israel, couldn't be conceivably incorporated into the new Palestinian state. But It's not clear. Originally, it looked like there would be a formal proposal that then both sides could either, you know, could agree to or not to agree to. And the hope there among Israeli moderates was that assuming the Palestinian Authority would accept such a proposal and Netanyahu reject it, Israelis would say, "Hey, you know, looks like we can have peace, but Netanyahu is avoiding it." There would be new elections, and a more moderate coalition would come to power that would then make peace. But the most recent reports, the leaks that have come out in Haaretz and some of the Israeli media, appear that Kerry and Obama are backing off. Instead, are just going to propose another framework, you know, similar to the roadmap and Oslo and others. Which will may mean that just, you know, negotiations are going to drag on, you know, ad infinitum, while you know, Israel continues to expand the settlements and the like. And the concern about this is that this may be the last best hope for a two-state solution. Indeed, ironically, the biggest enemy of Zionism, that is, of maintaining a Jewish state of Israel, may be Netanyahu and the refusal of the United States to push Israel to compromise. My view is that we should in no way compromise our historic commitment to Israel's right to peace and security and to be a guarantor of that right, but that we need to practice some tough love. That is, to be willing to push Israel to make the necessary compromises for peace. I mean, there are those who say, oh, we can't pressure Israel, we can't criticize Israel, Israel's our friend. But, you know, what does a friend do, if you see your friend drunk at a bar with the keys, car keys in his hand, stumbling towards his automobile? A friend, you know, takes the keys away and says, I will not let you hurt yourself or others. And I've told this analogy to my Israeli friends. They generally agree with me, except they extend the analogy further, saying the United States is the bartender. We're the enabler. We're pouring the stuff. And really, I think Israel will be far more secure within its internationally recognized borders than trying to defend an archipelago of illegal settlements and military outposts amidst a hostile population. There are more Israelis, troops outside of Israel maintaining the occupation than inside Israel defending the country. And remember, the Palestinians and the entire Arab world has pledged security guarantees and full diplomatic relations in return for a withdrawal that would establish a viable Palestinian state. I mean, buffer zones may have made sense when Arab armies were threatening to wipe it off the map, but, you know, that's no longer the case. And besides, the only threat to Israel nowadays, you know, given how superior they are militarily, is long-range missiles and terrorist attacks, which buffer zones don't prevent. So that this is why I think it's really important for the United States to take a tough love approach, and not just for the Palestinians' sake, but for the sake of Israel, and to push the Netanyahu government to make the necessary compromises for peace. Thank you.